associate pastor of the Sacred Heart Parish in Nogales, Arizona, which is right on the Mexican border. He was convicted in last week's Sanctuary Movement trial. They both spoke with Fresh Air associate producer Amy Salad. It's 2.5 minutes after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY FM in Philadelphia. With me now on Fresh Air is novelist Martin Cruz Smith, who's best known for his 1981 thriller Gorky Park. The novel follows a Soviet detective as he unravels the mysterious murders of three people found shot, mutilated, and frozen in Gorky Park. The novel was praised by critics for transcending the genre and for its detailed descriptions of life in the Soviet Union. Gorky Park was published in 1981, and by that time, Smith had written about 35 other novels. Most of them were genre books, westerns, detective stories, thrillers, which he wrote under pseudonyms. His 1977 novel, Nightwing, a horror story about vampire bats in Hopi territory, was one of the earlier books released under his own name. Martin Cruz Smith's new book, Stallion Gate, is set in New Mexico in 1945 at Los Alamos, where America's leading scientists are preparing to test the first atom bomb. Smith uses several historical figures in his book, including Robert Oppenheimer, who's one of the fathers of the bomb. The main character who Smith created for the novel is Joe Pina, who is the driver and bodyguard of Oppenheim. He's an Indian who boxes and plays jazz. This character combines elements of Smith's heritage. His father is a jazz musician, his mother an Indian rights activist. Stallion Gate is published by Random House. Martin Cruz Smith grew up in Philadelphia and is an alumni of the University of Pennsylvania. He now lives in California. Welcome back to Philadelphia.
Thank you. Thank you.
And welcome to Fresh Air. Your first, 35 books were written?
Well, I don't know if there were 35. There comes a point at which you do lose track, and maybe you lose track somewhere between 20 and 30. I don't know. But I don't know how many books I wrote. I don't think I wrote 35 before that. It's, you know, it's appalling to think about. It's like walking out into a cemetery and seeing about 30 of your own gravestones.
That's how good you felt about the books?
Oh, no. It's just that, you don't want to think that you sort of went through so much before anything else happened.
Some of the names you used were Martin Quinn, Jake Logan, Simon Quinn.
Simon Quinn, yeah.
Nick Carter.
Yeah.
What makes a good pseudonym?
Well, I tell you, Nick Carter, for example, I was Jake Logan and Nick Carter. But I was like many other writers, I was a writer for hire. Nick Carter as a brand name has existed for almost 100 years. And I don't know, generations of writers, good and bad, have been Nick Carter at some time. Generally at their most desperate point, that's when they become Nick Carter.
Is that the author of a certain detective?
Well, it's a Nick Carter series, and the plots are so inane, and God knows I should know, I once tried to distinguish mine from somebody else's. I couldn't do that, and I really couldn't follow the plot. I wrote my Nick Carter in 8 days, and that included 1 day for research. So you're writing, you're a desperate man, and you are writing quickly.
Typing
that's
quickly,
one kind,
too. Go
that's
ahead.
One,
it's like you don't
yeah,
have to type that much.
Yes. And since I am a bad typist, it was all the more painful. So sometimes you're just fulfilling a job. With Jake Logan, I was doing a Western, and I enjoyed that. I'd never done a Western before, with gunfighters. It was fun to do that. But other times, I did a thing called The Inquisitor, which was a spy series with some humor to it. I think I rather it proved at that time that humor did not mix well with espionage because the book sold successively fewer each time. It was about a man who killed for the Pope, and every time he killed some foreign agent, would come back to the Vatican and have to do penance and wear a hair shirt. It was a charming concept, but it turned out to be a fairly private one.
How much do you have to know about a genre before you write a book like that that's just meant to be, like a quote, good read and a good seller?
Well, you can steep yourself in the genre if you want. I just wanted to learn how to write. All this stuff, all these paperbacks are just a means of learning how to write. And I think it's very nice that some paperback publisher was willing to pay me while I learned how to write. So you have to keep stepping up. You have to constantly write better than, in fact, you really have to. Because you're always aiming above this field. You want to get beyond. It's fine to spend time in this field and spend time in that field, but you want to keep on moving. Because if you stay, you become ultimately, finally, nothing more than a genre writer.
What did you learn from writing those genres that you think you were able to apply to the more serious books that you've written?
Well, one thing that you learn if you do this kind of work is that you learn you have to have a fairly strong narrative line. You have to have a pretty strong and defined central character and some other characters, and you had better get the book had better have an end. You know, you have to have a compelling beginning. You have to have some complications in the middle, and something has to end. You know, this sounds primitive, and yet it's something that in fact any writer has to learn again and again. It seems that after you finish the book, it's almost as if at that point you forget everything you learned, and then you have to learn it again with the next book because as you learn those characters, the characters in the setting of the next book. They themselves are so overwhelming. It takes you a long time to get a shape on it and to direct them towards your ends, at least to some degree.
It's interesting because you've really emphasized like juicy storylines, which is something that some
not
modern fiction
no,
has.
No, not a juicy.
Well,
story
when I
line.
Say juicy, that's maybe the wrong word, but a taut story.
Oh, I meant you didn't mean a salacious.
I didn't mean it like that at all. But. So something that really moves.
Yes,
and that's
I mean, there really is.
Yeah.
I love the movement that a book should have. I want some book to move, to go someplace, to do something. I have to be carried with it. I do this. Also, I do something else. At the very beginning, when I think about the character, I realize I'm going to be stuck with this person for 3 years. Matter of fact, I'm going to be alone in a room with this person for 3 years, and I had better like him or her. I have to like these people and care about them a great deal if I'm going to spend that kind of time with them.
What was your first breakthrough out of the genre books you were writing and into fiction that you really wanted
to call
your
own? Well,
I
think it was Nightwing because I began with a very simple commercial need, which was that I was starving, this was bad. So I needed to make some money. And I looked around for what was happening. Then everyone was suffering from the Jaws syndrome, particularly the publishers were suffering from the Jaws syndrome. I decided to fulfill that craving on their part and to write something like that involving vampire bats. And then I thought, my God, I can't really write about vampire bats. It's got to be something else to the story. So I introduced the Indian element. I thought, well, how nice to have a book beginning with some little old Indian saying he's going to end the world and then using the bats as the function. And then I got more and more interested in the people and less interested in the bats. And so I ended up with a half and half, half this beast, half that. The book never was as good as it could have been for two reasons. One was I didn't have enough money to go to Arizona and spend time in the Hopi land, so I had to use my experience, my memory of New Mexico, and the other one was that it still was, I think, bore that birthmark of greed, and so it never took off the way it should have if I'd given myself entirely to it.
Did you do any research on vampires and
vampire
bats?
Oh, sure, I did a lot of research on vampire bats, and it was the kind of research where you go down and read absolutely everything, and go and look at some bats at the zoo. But the only time I ever had bats, vampire bats, close to me was when finally I went on a promotional tour, and I remember I went on a Good Morning America on Halloween Day some years back, and I was there to promote my book. And they were going to have me on as a bat expert. And I was babbling on about bats. And underneath me, without my even knowing it, they've got this little title, Martin Cruz Smith, Bat Expert. And I think I deserved that.
I thought you were going to tell me that they actually brought out some bats for you.
I had bats. I had vampire bats. I was actually touring with two vampire bats. And it was boy, that was... That was humiliation.
What did you think of the movie?
That was something. The movie. I'm sorry. Now we've gone to the next stage of humiliation. The movie. I got to Columbia, and I get to the lot, and I step out, and here comes a man running across the lot, waving his arms frantically. A very nice guy with long black hair, and he stops me and says, "Are you Martin Cruz Smith?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I am so and so." His name was Nick Mancuso, an honorable man. He said, "I'm the lead I'm the star of your new movie, Nightwing, and I just want to tell you privately. I want to apologize privately, and if you'd like, I'd do it publicly for what we're doing to your book. And this that was my introduction to the movie Nightwing.
Oh, are you sorry you sold the rights for it?
Well, I not only sold the rights, but I wrote the original screenplay, which was then changed and changed and changed. I'm not sorry. It just is something that happens when you write a book. The book is not the pre-promotion for a movie, but I am like anybody else of my age. Growing up in America, we liked movies. I am an absolute sucker for movies. I continue to hope that a good movie will be made from a book of mine.
Well, a movie was made from Gorky Park, which is your best-known book. Were you happy
yes.
with that?
Well, I tell you, going past seeing Nightwing was going past a horrendous accident in the road in which bodies are strewn up and down the highway. And in Gorky Park, it was like passing by and seeing that only some car had broken down. You know, it was a lesser accident. I was disappointed because I'd gone to some real effort in Gorky Park to present people, to present Russians who were warm, who were cold, who were you know, fully dimensioned human beings. And then to see it made in which we merely have cold, ahuman, inhuman characters was really to have completely missed the point of the book. And they tried to follow the plot to some degree, but they missed the character. They missed what was human in the book.
My guest is Martin Cruz Smith, and his books include Gorky Park, his new book Stallion Gate, which has just been published. When you started Gorky Park, had you been to the Soviet Union yet?
Well, I wrote a long outline and sold it to a publisher about an American detective going to Moscow and solving this crime. I had not been there at that time. And I applied for a visa. The only way I could get in, I could only get a 15-day visa, because they put you into groups and they put you in boxes and move you that way. So I only spent 15 days in the Soviet Union, 5 days in Moscow. And that's the total of my experience, first-hand experience in Moscow. But they were my 15. I have never. It's an interesting thing when you do that, because you see when you apply yourself so clearly. It's as if you know, you're taken off as if there were a layer of skin on your eyes, and you took off that layer of skin because you see so clearly.
What were you looking for when you were there? You knew you were going to be writing a book.
Well, I saw so much more than I anticipated. You know, I was imagining what my trip would be in New York. And so I had an outline of all the places I had to go, this scene, this scene, this scene. So I was just going to go there to get the scene right. And when I got there, suddenly it was the very atmosphere. It was the air pressure itself that seemed so important. The color of things seemed so important. The way people walked was important. The way people met or didn't meet your eyes. And then I would start getting lost, because I don't speak Russian. I have a very flimsy grasp of the Cyrillic alphabet. I'd start getting lost, and I'd end up in a part of town that I'd never imagined. And this part of town was far more interesting than anything I'd imagined. So that kind of experience was what rushes at you if you're at the place. And once that happened, I stopped forgetting about an American detective.
It's a remarkable thing when you're a newcomer in a foreign place, because you see everything with fresh eyes.
Yes.
And everything is exciting, and details that people who live there wouldn't even notice anymore because they take it for granted, you see.
Yes.
But on the other hand, the longer you're there, the more you start to question sometimes those first impressions
yes.
that you have. So how much did you trust those two remarkable weeks that you spent there?
Well, I spent those two remarkable weeks. First, I'd read as much as I possibly could. Then I went. And then I started a long-term relationship with a number of Russians in New York. And these were people who were defectors or emigres, with an experience not only with Russia but with Russian law. And they I had them, I interviewed them again and again and again until they stopped being informers and they became friends. At a point, they understood what I was actually trying to do, which was not just try to give a little Russian catnip to the flavor to the story, but in fact to present Russia, if at all possible, for an American writer. And then I would give them the manuscript and have them go through the manuscript line by line to say, is this what you see on this? If I got the street right, is that what you see there? Do you make a right turn here? There, do you make a left? How do you park? How does that car work? You know, absolutely everything. So that the experience is, you know, putting on the Russian overcoat and being in those shoes and having that taste in your mouth. Everything.
What are some of the recurring things that Soviet emigres who were in America told you that you just had to have in? I mean, there's just part of the Soviet experience, and you have to put it in.
Well, you know, part of the Soviet experience is their reaction to the United States, which is part of the last part of the book. For example, their favorite part of the book is, in fact, when Arkady gets to America, because that is to them, in a sense, even more their particular story. When he is in New York and he is seeing America for the first time, and hearing the noise and seeing the colors, and also facing the distrust from the FBI, because the FBI never believes that you may not be a double agent, and so that kind of suspicion and the garishness that Russians on you on one side and the suspicion from the other is something that they hadn't seen anyplace else. So that is what they appreciated most.
It's interesting that, you know, even people who aren't involved with a detective story or spy story, you know, would feel that they're being spied on from both sides and they're distrusted from both sides.
Well, it's curious, you know, when we go to Moscow and we're looking at looking up in the chandelier, we're looking under the bed for the bug, and that may be there, could well be there, but we don't think ever that when a Russian comes here, even if he's defected, put his life on the line to come here, that he himself may be under the same kind of suspicion and very likely will be all his life.
Are there any things that you changed because of the feedback that you got from Soviet emigres?
Yeah, one very crucial thing that I resisted for a long time, to my embarrassment. I didn't want Arkady to be a member of the Communist Party because I didn't want my hero, who I liked so much, to be a party member. And I didn't. It took away from him in terms of the sympathy for him. And also, I even had a fear that an American audience would not accept a protagonist who was a party member. And my Russian friends over the years, and this took years in the writing, would tell me again and again, annually, that he had to be a party member. He could not be a chief homicide investigator without being a party member. And finally, one of them who was a dissident, who had been sent to a prison camp for his activities by the KGB, told me that one of his best friends in Leningrad was a homicide investigator, chief homicide investigator, and a member of the Communist Party. And that, in fact, the character that I had made up was very much like his friends, and I felt if that was good enough for Yuri, that was probably good enough for me.
So you made him a member.
Yes.
My guest is novelist Martin Cruz Smith, and right now we're talking about his novel Gorky Park. His new novel is called Stallion Gate. You wrote an article, actually a review of a couple of books for Esquire a couple of years ago, and in it you wrote that every age has its operative analogy and that ours is espionage.
Yes.
What makes you think that?
No, I have to think back to that article.
so maybe you don't really feel so compelled about that idea.
I think that, you know, we have an age of such suspicion. We have an age in which information has to be gathered up surreptitiously. You know, and the way we talk about the rest of the world is intelligence itself, with a capital I, has come to stand for intelligence at all in terms of the rest of the world. And this is often misleading. I hesitate to say it quite so much on a domestic level.
But do you think that writing espionage stories somehow, like, ties into the American ethos now?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I'd have to think about that a second, and then it'll occur to me about 2 minutes from now when I'm talking about something else.
Do you know any real detectives?
Yeah. Yeah, I know real detectives and real police. And I have been helped in the past by a number of New York police helped me, in fact, in Gorky Park. And later, it's amazing what people will tell you. When I did the Gypsy series, a couple of Gypsy detective stories some years back, the police helped me, and I went to St. Patrick's, and they let me run around the top of St. Patrick's Cathedral. Now, people just want you to get it right, and they're so pleased if you want to make any effort to get it right that they'll take you by the hand and lead you.
Are the lives of detectives as interesting as the lives of most detectives in literature?
I think they're far more interesting. In fact, the lives of detectives, the detectives I know, in fact, are full of both violence and humor. I think the lives of detectives, of course, have a lot more of that than the patrolmen, who serve quite rightly more, just as often as crossing guards.
Now, you also, for some of your novels, have to get into the psychology of the killer. And in Gorky Park, one of the characters says that murder is only half of it, and the other half is impressing the investigator and with what a great crime this was, seeing them reduced to impotence
that.
Also.
That was Arcadi who was
right,
saying
that. Yeah, yeah. Well, so...
so he's leading on. He's leading at that point. He's leading on Osborne. He says, don't you want to take credit for it? Don't you really at the heart of it? Doesn't it matter also that you get credit for being so smart? And I think we see again and again with killers who have been nailed that is part of what gets them caught, the chance to take credit for being so smart. They don't perhaps connect that allowing themselves to get caught belies the cleverness. No, that's an aspect of the killer, the desire for recognition that I think is important.
What about the desire for confession? Do you think when the point comes, when a killer does take credit for the crime, that there's a certain release in the confession?
Well, it depends on the character of the criminal. I think a bad criminal, the amateur criminal, wants to confess, and the psychotic criminal wants to take credit.
I don't know if you ever read this or not, but in the World Press Review, when Gorky Park came out, there's a column, at least back then, that was called a Communist View or Communist Perspective.
Yeah.
And there was a woman who writes for Soviet journals who reviewed your book very unfavorably and said that it was basically an anti-Soviet diatribe and
accused
the publisher of anti-Sovietism as well.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you saw that and how you reacted to that.
There was a big article in Soviet Literary Gazette, which is the organ of the Writers' Union. And it called me, among other things, anti-Soviet scum. The vigor in American criticism seems so pallid compared to a review like that. So anyway, he called me anti-Soviet scum, and then about a year later, he defected in London. And somebody asked him, "Well, how did you really feel about Gorky Park?" He said, "I thought it was great. I would never have written about it unless I thought it was great." So it's the fine art of reading between the lines, is something we have to keep in mind.
So in his own way, he publicized
the
book. Yes,
he felt exactly that. He felt he was publicizing the book, and the readers would understand, naturally understand. He wouldn't be writing about this book and attacking it unless it had great merit.
That's pretty funny. Is there spy fiction is there detective novels in the Soviet Union?
Oh, sure. There are detective novels and there are spy novels. Basically, the spy novels, of course, our CIA is treated as the KGB is there. And the police are... One thing about Soviet detective novels, police novels, is that they always get their man. They always get their man. And generally, they make the criminals make no real effort to escape because they know how guilty they are, how antisocial they are. And their behavior is generally regarded as aberrant, very far away from the norm. And also they're tainted by bourgeois tendencies, such as, let's see, sometimes it has to do with just lying around with a woman in the middle of the afternoon and having a beer is, well, that's a bourgeois tendency that many of us are prone to.
There were a lot of debates in the press when Gorky Park mm-hmm. came out about whether you were or weren't the next John le Carré.
I'm not.
But I wonder if you admire his work or have any writers like that who you admire.
I admire his work enormously.
But
because
don't
he writes with so much care.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that regard, I wouldn't mind being called another John le Carré.
But you were disturbed by part of that comparison.
Well,
too.
I think that doesn't do any service to either him or me. It's just an easy way to categorize. Who is he? Well, he's the next John le Carré. Maybe he's the next Mark Twain. Who is he? Who is he? Well, maybe he's himself. Maybe he's the new Martin Cruz Smith. You never know who somebody is. But there are a number of writers who I admire. Some of them are mystery writers, and some of them are writers.
Before writing Gorky Park, you had written a lot of genre books in which you had to follow the conventions because there were mass market books that were made to be bought and read quickly. But when you were writing Gorky Park, mm-hmm. It was a book you spent like close to 10 years on. Mm-hmm. You could labor over every word and dissect the plot and reorganize it in any way you chose to. Do you feel like you broke a lot of the conventions that you had learned?
Well, I tell you, I just want to correct. It's not a correction, but in 10 years, buying time.
Right.
Most of that time, in fact, at least half that time, I was writing other books.
I see.
To survive and buying myself time. I did not suddenly, I wish I had become independently wealthy and so I could have spent 10 years on it. But it is not a product of 10 years' work. It was a product. However, the time the writing took about 8 or 9 years. So I started at one point, ended at another. And although I was distracted by all these other books, I was, as a result of these other books, a better writer at the end than I was at the beginning. And also another thing happens is when you have a book that's been that you have to read again and again, you get to know what's good about it and what's not. What else were you saying?
If you violated any of the conventions that you learned from the other books.
You know, what I violated, what I did, was the simplest possible thing, which was just to make, instead of sending in another American detective to solve a crime in Russia, or another American secret agent, whatever, in fact, to use the man in place, which was simply to use a Russian in Russia. That was the violation, and it was, of course, the simplest, most obvious thing in the world to do.
Didn't your first publisher break the contract with you after you changed your mind about having the American detective going to the Soviet Union?
Well, I sold him an outline about an American detective in Russia. I came back from Russia and said, no, I have to do it this other way. I'm not going to do it the way I told you I would. And he told me that he would publish what I did, whatever I did, but not with much enthusiasm. Because he didn't believe I could do what I said I was going to do. And I insisted in buying the book back. And so he stood on principle, and I stood on principle. As a result, I didn't give him the book.
You got a terrific contract for it, though. How did you manage to do that?
Well, finally, one thing that happens, there are two things that happen. I'm up against the publisher. Publisher's up against me. Two people of great principle. What can happen to me in the meantime is that I might starve and give in. He might get fired.
That happens all the time.
That's what happens. And so when that happened, when finally he had moved on to another publishing house, I was able to buy the book back and then able to sell it someplace else.
My guest is novelist Martin Cruz Smith. He's the author of Gorky Park, and of the new novel, Stallion Gate. Was writing the new novel any easier for you since you'd had artistic and critical and popular success with Gorky Park? You know, did you feel like, well, I can do this. I can write this novel.
Well, I didn't want to do the same thing again, so whatever ease I might have gained for myself, I eliminated right at the start by saying I'm not going to do another Gorky Park and I'm not going to do another Russian novel. I want to do something American. And not only do I want to different story, but I want a completely different kind of hero, and even write in a different kind of style and have very different aims. So I don't know. I've never felt. I always feel that I'm going to operate best at the point of falling from a great height. So I tried it with this again.
Describe the premise that you're working with in Stallion Gate.
Well, the premise is the creation of the bomb and bringing back 1945 and bringing back Los Alamos again as a fresh, totally fresh experience to the reader. But this time not doing it from the point of view of a physicist, because I'm not a physicist. Instead, doing it from the point of view of one of the Indians who works at Los Alamos, as in fact the Indians did work at that secret laboratory, and not just another ordinary Indian, the Indian that people, kind of Indian that anyone might expect, but a sergeant in the army who was in fact a jazz musician. So, because I wanted to bring back the whole life of the time, the whole life that a man like that might have, and that includes music, it includes his own life apart from Los Alamos.
It seems that you've drawn on things that you knew from your parents to create that main character. Yeah. And I say that, you know, knowing that your father was a jazz musician, your mother was, I think, a jazz singer, and also headed an Indian rights group in the Delaware Valley.
Yeah, she is. She's a Pueblo Indian from New Mexico, and even somebody might feel, well, how could it, you know, 1945? How would an Indian possibly know about jazz? And well, my mother left. You know, my mother left New Mexico and went to New York and became a jazz singer. And when they talk about, you know, jazz in New Mexico, my parents were down there playing at that time. And there's a scene at a jazz club in Albuquerque that is in fact the place where my father played. And the band up there that's playing is my father's band. So I have used some. That's one musical element that's in it. I try to get the whole flavor, however, of jazz into it, just in the feel of the writing, of this kind of rhythm, which is a very American rhythm to a novel.
Did you grow up thinking of yourself as Indian?
Well, no, because I don't think anybody would take me for an Indian when I walked in a door. I didn't grow up on a reservation. I don't have that experience. There are other writers who have had that experience and write beautifully about it, for Louise Erdrich, for example. But I don't have that experience. I have a window on it, and that's all. And I can't claim any more than that.
How much awareness of that was there in your family? How much did your mother try to pass on to you what she knew of her heritage?
Well, she was keenly aware of it and was always intensely proud of it. And I'd say that pride was basically what she passed on, rather than any specific knowledge. There was no passing of the tribal secrets.
Well, you've written several books that have Native American characters in the lead. Has researching those books and developing the characters given you insights about yourself or about, you know, your family's history? Has that been important to you?
I don't think of it that way. I don't think of it that way at all. I think of it very coldly, as a matter of fact. I think of it as material to be used. And in the coldest, most manipulative, perhaps even cruelest way possible. Because otherwise, as soon as it gets to be, as soon as I attach a moral to it, it dies of me. You know, it gets on its knees and starts praying, and then I lose interest. I want that material to be alive, and I want something real and even vicious kicking, so that I can use it. Otherwise, it's no value at all.
Has it been useful for you, though, when, for instance, interviewing Indians who were around the Los Alamos Project to tell them that you're half Pueblo?
No. I think the Indians look at the Indians who look a lot more Indian than I do. They look at me coldly and say, "You look like a nosebleed Indian."
Meaning what?
Meaning you got about as much Indian blood in you as would come from a nosebleed. You know, so you know, on paper, I'm half Indian. But I think I look an awful lot more Spanish So when I'm talking to people who are in fact my friends, I'm keenly aware of the difference between being an Indian who looks it and who lives it, and the man who was a writer.
Well, I've been told by a lot of Native Americans that ever since the 1960s romance with Native American folklore, that everybody wants to be part Indian.
Oh, yes. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I was speaking to a Frenchman, and I said, where are you going? What are you doing now? I said, I'm going to do something in New Mexico. And he goes, ah, the Indians, your philosophy. And he goes, poof, as if that explained it. That poof was sort of an expression of such admiration and such magnificence. Nothing more need said. And he was, with that poof, suddenly half Indian himself. There is this romance. And down in Santa Fe, you can feel it. It's this suffocating blanket. But at the same time, the Indians are never fooled. Indians are not fooled by that stuff.
So, and you don't want to be fooled by that either.
No.
What kind of research did you do for the novel? What kind of people did you speak to?
Well, I spent time with people in the reservations around Los Alamos, and also a lot of time with people who were either in Los Alamos or had been in Los Alamos in 45. I went to people basically who had not written their memoirs. there's a danger of talking to people who have written their memoirs, because then everything they tell you has to jibe with their memoir. And this is, I don't want to create that kind of pressure on somebody. But I spoke to people who had worked with closely with Robert Oppenheimer and with Leslie Groves, General Leslie Groves, and had lived there through this experience. And again, as I had done in Gorky Park, after a great deal of interviewing with those people who knew the most, in fact, I went back again and had them look at the manuscript and go through it again word by word. So that you, which is a strange thing for these people, because you have looted their memory, and you've pulled it apart and refashioned it into a whole new living 1945 in Los Alamos, and they have to go through what is now their memory as changed by you and completely fiction at this point. What's interesting is their interest and their generosity. I think in large part because they're so tired of being judged by their children and grandchildren as monsters.
Why judged as monsters?
Because they are the people who created the atomic bomb. You know, they're tired of the casual prejudgment. They know, the people I work with, that I don't agree with everything they did or everything they say. All they hope from me is that I'm going to be fair. You know, that I will listen to them and present at least the fact that these were very good people doing what they did for what they believed to be the very best of reasons.
Now, you also interviewed a lot of Indians who were had been living around there, right?
In
1945.
Yeah.
What happened? Were a lot of people displaced once the Los Alamos project was?
No, the only people who were really displaced were the people who were running the Los Alamos Ranch School. And which was a very elite private school run almost as a Boy Scout camp on this mesa, which Robert Oppenheimer led General Leslie Groves to, and which they chose as this ideal place, this most isolated of places, not only isolated in terms of geography, but isolated by time itself, because there they would be separated from the rest of the world by these Indian reservations, which was surrounded as if by a time warp. Anybody crossing this would not only be out of place, but almost be out of time.
Did Indians express any fear that it was done there in part because, well, the first ring of people around the bomb are going to be Native American and not white Americans?
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think their first reaction was, I would say, that it was a source of employment, mm-hmm. which was vital in that it was then and is now. A sense of pride, because New Mexico was losing more casualties per capita than any other state in the Union during the war. A lot of people had died in Bataan, the death march in Bataan. Only as the project developed did the first misgivings develop, and the prophecy of the gourd of ashes began to pass around.
Yeah, explain that prophecy, which you mentioned in the book too,
which was that that there would be a gourd of ashes that would break, and from which these poison ashes would spread all around the world, completely cover the world and destroy it. And they fixed this gourd of ashes in Los Alamos. This was something that, in fact, was a Hopi prophecy. But the Hopi are, in terms of the pueblos of New Mexico, are close and honored cousins. And the Hopis tend to give the prophecy to the rest of the pueblos. So I incorporated this aspect into that also the misgivings that some of the scientists themselves had. Some of the most, it's surprising to see who had among the scientists the most misgivings.
What's surprising?
Well, that Edward Teller was the man who wanted to pass around the petition at Los Alamos so that the asking that the bomb not be used in Japan until it had been demonstrated to the Japanese. That's not the Edward Teller we tend to think of. We don't tend to think that Edward Teller was the first one to raise the possibility that the atmosphere might be ignited.
How close can you get to what was ground zero for that Los Alamos test?
You can stand right there.
Did you do that?
Yeah. I went there during... You can go... The public is allowed in one day a year. I went a second time on a sort of a private tour with the then director of Los Alamos and with a friend and with the general in charge of the White Sands Missile Range. And you stand in a sort of a depression in the center of which is this stub of cement. And coming out around you is nothing but sand, and coming up through the sand a little bits of stone, a glassy green stone. That is trinitite, which is the sand that was fused by that blast in July 1945.
And it's not radioactive there anymore?
Yes, it is. That's why they don't let you in. But it's low grade. It's something like the equivalent of 3 chest x-rays. So you are allowed in, but you're only allowed in for one day. Otherwise, that particular, it's caged practically. I mean, there's a big fence around, round fence around this site, Ground Zero, so that even soldiers who are at the range will not wander onto it.
What did you think about standing in the crater of the first atom bomb test?
Well, you don't see much, and you don't feel much. You're looking at the Ascaris Mountains over here. You're looking at some volcanic peaks over there. You don't feel much. It's when you start seeing more of it. You know, you're sort of disappointed. I was sort of disappointed standing there. I wanted to feel more, you know, when you go someplace and you expect an emotional charge, and I wasn't getting. But then when I started moving around and I went some places where the public did not generally go, such as the ranch house where the bomb, the core itself was actually assembled, and you start to feel again, you're standing in the room itself, and you see some of the graffiti that was scratched in the walls written there by the people who were making the bomb, then you start getting this sort of an eerie sense of the past being present, of the past still being there.
What kind of graffiti is scratched out there from the people?
I wish I remembered now. I wish I could recall it. But things just that somebody's name, somebody distance to some town.
Did you talk to people since the publication of the book, people who you'd interviewed who finally read the final draft?
Yes. Yes, people who have finally read the book. And that is the nicest, that's the best part of all, because if you've taken somebody's memory, if you've been given permission to go into somebody's memory and to use it as fiction, then you would damn well do it. I mean, you know, you figure you're going to do it well. You figure you're going to make a book out of it. But to still do it decently is more important.
Do you see yourself as making any...
Not more important, as important.
Do you see yourself as making any kind of nuclear statement in your book?
Well, I try to avoid the statement for the experience. As soon as you start doing a statement, the reader hears it. The reader hears you breaking in, tapping him on the shoulder and saying, now pay attention to this. This is important. And I try not to do that. I try to overwhelm the reader with the experience of Joe's experience of working at Los Alamos, of being an outsider, of seeing this bomb slowly come into existence, to see it take shape, to see it, to start the, see the core, to see the high explosive build and it take its actual physical shape and then be a trinity. I do not want to distract jar the experience by the narrator's voice.
My guest is novelist Martin Cruz Smith, and he's the author of Nightwing, Gorky Park, and the new novel, Stallion Gate. You know, we were talking about how the main character is a jazz musician, among mm-hmm. other things, and he talks, I think, during one jam session about how many jazz musicians are part Indian. And I don't know, what do you think? I've actually...
Well, there are two points when Indians themselves are mentioned with jazz. One of them is that, first of all, when he's talking about the musicians, the jazz musicians, he's talking about black jazz musicians who mentioned that who mentioned their Indian background. And an awful lot of black jazz musicians claim some degree of Indian background. And Joe thinks that, well, these are my Indians, you know. These guys are mine. The other one is a mention of a trombone player named Big Chief Ed Moore, who was a Pima Indian, about 400 pounds, played the trombone, and I mention him because, in fact, he used to play with my parents, and I remember. I still remember Big Chief Ed Moore. Getting into our, we had a Crosley station wagon, which is the smallest, not much bigger than the table we're seated at. And every time when Big Chief got in, the whole thing, you know, you just wondered, was this going to, if we're going to go right down to the ground, the whole framework, you know, would the wheels have room to turn? So I wanted to get Big Chief in there.
You know, when we started the interview, we were talking about some of the pen names that you wrote under when you were first getting started and writing a lot of genre books. But your given name was, I think...
Martin
William Smith?
Right.
Why did you change it from Martin William to Martin Cruz Smith?
Well, I wrote under the name Martin Smith. And then I discovered at a certain point that there were a number of other Martin Smiths who were writers, and we were all listed together under books in print. My agent suggested I change my name. I didn't want to do that. So I thought I'd put something else in the middle and something not in itself that would be a sleeping pill. And so I looked into both sides of the family looking for something that would help me along there. And the shortest thing I could find was Cruz.
Which was from where?
My mother's side. Yeah, I had a number of names to choose from. Like my grandfather was a Martin Lopez, who was a Yaqui Indian out of Mexico, and then there was my family names like Montenegro. But I don't think you can get Martin Montenegro Smith onto a book jacket. Cruz was the shortest thing I could get.
Was your mother pleased?
Oh yes, very pleased because it's suddenly this whole side of the family comes. It develops and takes part in it.
Do you think that name recognition has helped you, having that very distinctive Cruz as a middle name?
I don't think it helps at all unless you can write.
Right. you talked about how you wanted Stallion Gate to be very different from Gorky Park, so that you would be stretching yourself as a writer and also so that you couldn't just be typed into one category. Yeah. Do you know what your next book is going to be?
Well, I was thinking of doing something English about the women's rights. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know. I will find some place I want to, what I'll most likely do is find some place I want to be for a year and then find an excuse to be there.
Do you enjoy life more when you're in the middle of a book or between books?
I guess I'm odd in that I like writing more than having written. I like the idea. I like having that half of the brain full instead of empty.
Yeah, I think that is unusual.
I have that right now. Right now, I feel like half of my brain is to let.
Oh, because there's no novel spinning
around
in
there. Yeah.
So did you wait for something to come? Did you wait just for an idea to come?
Well, you know, I spent a year trying to write a book, another book about New Mexico, before I realized that I had to write it. I wanted to write about Los Alamos, because I was going to do a contemporary novel, and I wanted to go immediately into another book. And it took me a long time for my brain to let go of Gorky Park, and I had this other idea, and it was a nice idea about geothermal development in New Mexico. But then somebody mentioned Los Alamos to me, and then I drove past Stallion Gate, and in the course of a day, and this was about a year into the working of the book, and then just one day of real thinking, I realized that I was going to do an entire book for one flashback of Santa Fe and of Los Alamos, and this was crazy. If that's what I wanted to do, that's what I should do.
A lot of people say you should write what you know about, write what's closest to you, and you've really looked outside of yourself for the subject matter.
I like to look
as far as I can, if
there's something about writing about something that's such an enormous distance that frees up the brain, that allows you to really use yourself completely and gather in so much in that distance between you and it. Now, what you find when you get there, if you find some elements of yourself when you get there, that's a nice surprise.
Do you think
but I don't try that.
Do you think you'll ever do a novel that's more introspective, more about your life?
I still have a couple of other good ideas. far away ideas.
You grew up in Philadelphia.
Pretty much, yeah.
And you haven't been here for a long time.
Yeah.
And here you are today. How does the city look to you?
Well, the city looks great. I've spent most of the day sort of, you know, every time when I have a chance, I just walk around. Went down the South Street Seaport and just, you know, just wanted to be outside and see that. And then when I came here, I came here a little early and just walked around this neighborhood just to be here, because the whole city is so different. I thought I remembered it, and now it's so changed. I don't feel... I feel almost as if somebody's been playing with my memory. It's not fair. I don't like that.
You know, I have one last question. Since you enjoy so much going to other places and looking at the lives of people who are different from you, how come you haven't tried journalism? Or maybe you have.
I have.
Oh, you used to, actually.
I used to be a reporter. I used to be with the AP, and I was really pretty bad at that. And I used to be with the Daily News, and I was better at that because the Daily News... The Daily News encouraged a certain dramatic writing that the AP did not, because the AP is, you know, the wire service is going out to a Republican paper here, a Democratic paper here, a paper here that, you know, is born again, and another paper that encourages sodomy. You don't know what, but you have to please them all. Whereas with the Daily News wants, you know, give me some more flavor here. And it was that encouragement that appealed to me so much, that, you know, the chance to write even while you're doing journalism. But, you know, to do the stories at such a great distance, even better than, you know, some murder in Nicetown or Germantown. But to do a story about a murder so far away gives you a chance to gather in so much more and raise the tabloid style to some greater effort.
Okay, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks
for being here. My guest has been novelist Martin Cruz Smith, and his new novel is titled Stallion Gate. It's just been published by Random House. He's also well known for his novel Gorky Park, and he grew up here in Philadelphia, currently lives in California. Thank you again for being with us. It's 4.5 minutes to 5 o'clock. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening next week on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Jam traffic on the Pennsylvania Turnpike eastbound east of Norristown. State police are now on the scene of an accident there. Traveling north on 95, heavy between Penn's Landing and the Ben Franklin Bridge. About a 5-minute delay. Schuylkill Expressway westbound, 30 minutes in traffic from Montgomery through City. Slowing again between Belmont and Gladwin eastbound, a 20-minute delay between Gulf Mills and the Conshohocken Curve, then slow from Montgomery through Girard. Into New Jersey, the ramp from River Road to northbound Route 73 in Palmyra is blocked by an overturned truck. That's Shadow Traffic. I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM, WHYY.
The Shadow Traffic Report was funded by the Philadelphia Business Journal. This Sunday at 6 on The Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be crime writer Nicholas Pileggi, whose new book is called Wise Guy: Life in a Mafia Family. This Monday at 3 o'clock on Fresh Air, we're going to feature an interview with Fred Rogers, also known as Mr. Rogers. At 4 o'clock, we continue the Marion McPartland Piano Jazz Series with her guest, Junior Mance. This Tuesday at 4 o'clock, my guest will be Gail Sheehy, best known for the book Passages and author of the new book, The Spirit of Survival. Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by music critic Stephen Davis, who's written a new book called Hammer of the Gods, The Story of Led Zeppelin, which is based on a period of time that he spent touring with that band. And at 4 o'clock, we begin a two-part series called Down and Out, The Crisis of Homelessness in America. And the series was produced by Maeve McGoran and Greg Allen. And we're going to feature two follow-ups at 4:30 Wednesday and Thursday, panel discussions with people from Philadelphia who are working with the homeless. Friday afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by John Phillips, who used to be in the Mamas and Papas and has just written an autobiography. And then Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, we're going to feature a live concert in our music studio with singer Peggy King, who's going to be doing a concert of songs by Irving Berlin, and that's in celebration of his 98th birthday, which is this Sunday. And she'll be accompanied by bassist David Fink and pianist Corky Hale. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Audrey Vablaitis was our engineer. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Amy Sallet. Danny Miller and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a very good weekend. WHYY FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up from National Public Radio. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nina Totenberg.
This is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
The most interesting example I had was a secondary school math teacher who was the head of a local chapter of NOW. We watched her math lesson. We videotaped it. And she was teaching boys about five times as much as she was teaching girls.
Studies show teachers give more instructional time to boys than girls. Tonight on All Things Considered, sex stereotypes in the classroom.
And these stories, dangerous forest fires in the southeast.
Entombing the Chernobyl nuclear reactor.
Don't be confused. Experts say there was at least a partial meltdown.
In Congress, the House votes to take away some presidential power.
Texas teachers pass.
Will Goucher go co-ed?
And the hard work of comedy.
First, we have a roundup of this hour's news.
This is Laurie Waffen-Schmidt. International experts say a partial meltdown did occur at the Chernobyl nuclear plant in the Ukraine. A spokesman for International Atomic Energy Agency official Morris Rosen said the meltdown did not go through the concrete floor of the plant, thus avoiding a so-called China syndrome incident. Rosen, who has been at the Chernobyl site, said today that the fire there is now out, although temperatures around the damaged reactor remain high. Rosen said radiation levels appear to be falling, and the danger of any further meltdown is remote. Workers have already begun to pour concrete underneath the reactor to seal up the damaged core that will then serve as a foundation from which the rest of the structure can be entombed. Meanwhile, West German officials said today they will seek an international conference to set worldwide safety standards at nuclear power plants. A spokesman for Chancellor Helmut Kohl said the German leader is writing to Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, asking that all information about the Chernobyl incident be released to the international community. Parched conditions are hampering North Carolina firefighters as they battle to contain a raging forest fire in the eastern portion of the state. Local officials have begun evacuating residents in the path of the fire, which has consumed at least 20,000 acres so far. In other parts of the southeast, the drought is forcing water rationing in some communities and threatening local farmers with crop failure. Governor George Wallace wants Alabama declared a federal disaster area. U.S. and Israeli officials are denying reports of an imminent Israeli attack on Syria. CBS reported yesterday that Israel is preparing to retaliate for the attempted bombing of an El Al jet at Heathrow Airport last month. Jim Letterman reports from Jerusalem on the Israeli reaction.
Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres today called for a de-escalation in the rhetoric being heard recently both in Israel and in Syria. He stated that Israel has no intention of attacking Syria and added that as far as he knew, Syria did not intend to attack Israel tomorrow. Senior Israeli army officers, too, have been sounding a cautionary note. The army is now going through a serious and painful series of budget cuts and cannot easily afford a large-scale battle with Syria. But that does not mean that there are not voices presenting opposite opinions. The former chief of military intelligence, for example, claimed tonight that Israel has to strike a small but painful blow at Syria now. Otherwise, he warned, Syria will take Israel's inaction in the face of continued terrorist attacks as a sign of weakness, and Damascus is then liable to launch a full-scale assault in Lebanon that will threaten Israel's northern border. For National Public Radio, this is Jim Letterman in Jerusalem.
The Spanish government today ordered the arrest of senior army officer Carlos de Mer Ribera, who met with Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi to seek financing for extremist activities. The consul general of the Libyan mission in Madrid has been ordered to leave for his role in arranging the meeting. From Madrid, the BBC's Jeremy Harris.